Thank you. Well, it's very exciting to be here to speak to you at this rather amazing time in the field. We have just had a real discovery, and we don't know everything there is to know about it, and so there's a lot more to learn. And I'm going to try today to give you a little bit of a feel for what we know, what we don't know, and what the key issues are that we face in the field at this time. The question of there being an experimental, on the question of there being an experimental colloquium 2 weeks from now, I believe it is, I'm going to stick very much to the theory here to give Pierre Savard full rein on the experimental side. So this colloquium has more of the theoretical background in it than I normally give. So it's a bit of a new colloquium. We'll see how it goes. But as you'll see, there's a lot of deep theoretical issues that stand behind this, these developments. This picture here is the outline of the Large Hadron Collider tunnel, which is underground about 100 meters. The CERN laboratory is over here. There's the Geneva airport, if you can see it. So this is a big operation. And you're probably all aware that on July 4th, there was a lot of excitement at the laboratory with various bits of data being thrown around, various people giving exciting presentations, and various cheering appearing on the front page of the New York Times. This, of course, was the discovery of a new particle. And what I want to try to talk to you today about is about what this all means. What's the context? It's an amazing moment. It's important to see it in perspective. It's the end of a quest that has been going on for nearly 50 years. But it's also embedded with an even larger saga, which has been going on for more than a century and is still going on. So this is definitely not the end of the story. There's a long way to go. The discovery that was made in July is something we just are barely beginning to have some sense for what it might mean. The implications are not known, but they will be big. We just don't know in what way. So I thought it would be good to start at the beginning. What do we know about nature from the point of view of high-energy physics and sort of our conception of how the universe works? Well, as far as we can tell, we live in a world which is fundamentally quantum mechanical. And that world consists of space-time, which is probably quantum mechanical in some way. And in that space-time are fields like the electromagnetic field or the electron field. And these fields are quantum mechanical in nature, and that means that waves in those fields are actually made from quanta, which we call particles. So the electromagnetic field has waves, we call them light, we call that light, and light is made from photons. Similarly, the electron field has waves, those are made from electrons. And the universe itself, well, it's a big place, it's expanding, at an accelerating rate, which we only discovered 15 years ago. That's what we call, due to some sort of dark energy or cosmological constant. It's not really energy, but it is certainly dark. And most of the matter in the universe is not ordinary matter. It's something which doesn't shine. It doesn't interact with photons. And so it's of at least one or more types of matter out there are what we call dark matter. Now, here is that world sort of organized in terms of the fields and the particles of nature that we know about so far. So there are the fields over here, which constitute what I'm going to call what we call the standard model. But there's plenty of other stuff that might be out there. So let's see. First of all, there are forces in nature that we know about. There are four of them so far, five depending on how you count. There's gravity, of course. We all know about gravity. Gravity affects everything, which is why it's in this huge box. And then there are three forces that appear within the standard model. Those are the electromagnetic force, the weak nuclear force, and the strong nuclear force. And there may be other forces out there that we don't know about yet. Each of the forces is associated with fields, and their corresponding particles. So electromagnetism is associated with the photon. The weak nuclear force is associated with particles called the W and the Z. And the strong nuclear force is associated with particles called the gluons. All of those particles are bosons. And then there are the particles which we normally think of as making up matter, although that's not really the best way to think about it. Just there are a bunch of fermions which are present, fermionic fields and their corresponding particles. There are the charged leptons, which include the electron itself and its two heavy cousins, three types of neutrinos, six types of quarks. And they interact with these forces via these lines that I've drawn here. And then within the standard model, there's a Higgs, but I'll come back to that. Now, there may be other sectors of particles we haven't discovered yet. In fact, there's some hint that there might be such things. Dark matter may be particles of a sort that don't interact with any of the known forces except for gravity. And then dark energy really isn't particles, it's something else. So that's a long story, and we don't even know how to tell it yet. But that's our conception of the world today. Ordinary matter, stuff we're made from and all around us, is made up from electrons orbiting atomic nuclei, which are made from up and down quarks and bound together by gluons, and the atoms are bound together by the photon. All of this made possible because of the Higgs, because if there weren't a Higgs, the electron would be massless, and massless electrons can't form atoms. If you remember the formula for the Bohr radius, it's got a 1 over the mass of the electron in it. All the forces play a role in other important processes in nature, such as fusion in stars, supernovas. Gravity gets involved there, and all of the other forces get involved. And the neutrinos get involved, too. So these forces are not abstract things that only particle physicists study. They're important to us. Okay, we wouldn't be here in any detail without these forces in each of their details. And so, you know, we should try to understand them as well as we can. So the four forces of nature, again, I've listed them here: electromagnetic, which is involved in atomic structure; strong nuclear interactions, which are involved in nuclear structure and in protons and neutrons themselves; the weak nuclear interaction, which plays a role in radioactivity and in supernovas and in fusion; and gravitational interactions, which, of course, holds it all together. And then there's the Higgs, which in some sense is a fifth interaction, although we won't really see any impact of that in the near future, except for the presence of particle masses, which I'll describe in a minute. Now, each of these four forces has some sort of scale associated with it. The scales come from completely different places. In fact, electromagnetism doesn't really have a scale. The scale of atoms is really set by the electron mass. But still, in some sense, for electromagnetism, that's the scale we're most interested in, the scale of atoms, which you can either think about it in terms of distances, or you can convert distances to energies via a suitable use of H bar and C. And I'll go back and forth between these. So for the atomic scale, we're looking in the EV to MeV range, radii of these orders. For the strong nuclear interaction, that's the size of the proton. That's the distance scale, 10 to the minus 15 meters. Or in energy, that's GeV. MeV is a million electron volts. GeV is a billion. TeV, a trillion. The weak nuclear interaction scale gets us to a TeV, or in distance scale, 10 to the minus 18 meters. And that's the scale of the Higgs, as we'll see. And then if you want to really understand where gravity becomes quantum mechanical, you have to go 15 orders of magnitude further. And we're probably not going to get to that anytime soon, so don't hold your breath. But the LHC is a really important machine. The Large Hadron Collider is an essentially important machine because it's the first time in 40 years that we have a machine that has reached a new physical scale, where we have good reason to think something interesting will happen. And indeed, something has. Now, to understand the Higgs, you have to understand that two of the forces of nature, the weak nuclear force and the electromagnetic force, are actually bound together in some interesting way. They're tied up together in some interesting way. So I'm going to explain this to you by telling you a story. Okay. Once upon a time, there were two long-range forces in nature. Electromagnetism is a long-range force. Well, there used to be two of them. One was called weak isospin. There were three particles associated with it called the W1, the W2, and the W3. And there was another force called hypercharge with a particle called the Y. All of these particles were photon-like, spin 1, massless. And all the particles of that we call matter or fermions, the electrons, the neutrinos, the quarks, they were all massless. And then something happened. And that something was the Higgs mechanism, and everything changed. First, two of the W bosons and some mixture of the W and the Y, W3 and the Y, became heavy, became massive. We call those the Ws and the Z. And as a result of these particles becoming massive, this force became weaker and short range. This is what we call the weak nuclear force. Meanwhile, the other linear combination of these two particles became what we call the photon and remained a long range force. That's electromagnetism. And finally, in this process, all those fermions, which were massless, became massive with a wide diversity of masses. And that's how our world became what it is today. The Higgs mechanism is responsible for this. The problem is this story is not complete. These particles don't form a complete set. The Higgs mechanism predicts there must be some additional new physics at the scale which is of order a TeV in energy, which is the scale accessible to the Large Hadron Collider. We don't know, in principle, just from theory, what that should be. But we know it has to be accessible. It could be Higgs particles, new forces, a bunch of different things. But this is the question which the Large Hadron Collider was designed to answer. What is it that fixes this problem? And I'll say a little bit more about that problem in a minute. Well, right now, in fact. See, the problem is that if you take the forces that we know about, just the Standard Model, forget about gravity, forget about all the dark stuff, just focus on this stuff. The three forces of nature that form the Standard Model and the particles that they contain, this is not a consistent theory. This makes no sense. You write down the equations for this, you calculate things, and you discover that if you were to take two W bosons and scatter them off each other and go to sufficiently high energy, the amplitude, the quantum mechanical amplitude for this to occur, grows and grows and eventually violates unitarity. Well, unitarity is probability conservation. This is just not acceptable. Okay. So you know you have to add something here. You don't necessarily know what it is. It might be new particles, might be new force, but you have to add something. So this is a serious problem. It's a tear in the theory, and you have to repair it somehow. And the simplest possible repair, which is what we call the Standard Model, not the only possible repair, but the simplest repair is to put one Higgs field and its corresponding Higgs particle into the theory. And in order to avoid this problem, that particle must be lighter than one TeV. It must be light enough, in other words, to be accessible to the Large Hadron Collider. Okay. Now, I've just shown you this nice table of all the particles. Here's another nice table of facts about nature. All the chemical elements, everything's nicely organized by chemical type. You see all the masses and the atomic numbers. It's very pretty. Well, you take a look at the Standard Model, and you organize it in a similar way, and it doesn't look so simple. Here are the masses of the various particles in purple. Again, I remind you, MeV is 10 to the 6 electron volts. A proton has a mass of 938 MeV. The electron has a mass of half an MeV. The top quark has a mass of 175,000 MeV, roughly. Neutrinos are down at 10 to the minus 6 or less. We don't even know what the masses are exactly yet. These things are scattered all over the place. You see the pattern? Neither do we. All right. In fact, back when we were students, we didn't know what the top quark mass was. And if you looked at this table without this line here, you would say, okay, let's see, these two are pretty close. These two aren't too far. Probably the top quarks maybe 40,000, 50,000, 60,000. Well, this was a surprise. And the next thing everyone said is, wow, look at how big this is compared to everything else. It must be really special. I'll bet the top quark's really different from what the Standard Model predicts. It must be something really different and new about it. Well, we've been studying it for a while, and the data from the LHC seems to say, and all from previous colliders, seems to say it's kind of what you'd expect from the equations. It doesn't seem to be doing anything special, even though it's so heavy. So there's this problem. Why do the masses show this weird pattern? What's going on? And we have no idea. This is called the flavor problem. And it's bad. It's serious. Clearly, we don't understand something. But it used to be worse than this, because we also didn't even understand why you could have masses at all in this theory in the absence of the Higgs. Of course, the Higgs has been added in now. We now know what the Higgs mass is. That's also kind of a random number, 125 GeV. I don't know why. But we don't even know why any of these particles have mass, or more precisely, we didn't used to. And here's the reason. And this is the reason why the Higgs idea was invented in the first place, or had to be invented. Or it's one of two reasons, and I'll show them both at one level or another. So let me start with the fermions. Let me start with the electron in particular. I've already told you, having the electron with a mass is pretty important, right? No mass for the electron, no atoms. In quantum mechanics class, do you worry about this? No, you just, you write p squared over 2m, and you go and calculate. And nobody ever asks in quantum mechanics class, how did you get that thing? Where did it come from? And you go to quantum field theory class, and it's the same. And it was the same in the people did actually worry about this in the early part of the 20th century. They tried to figure out where the electron mass comes from, but they couldn't figure it out. So the equations just got an m stuck in it, and off you went, m for mass. And the problem is that then in 1957, it was discovered that the weak nuclear force violates parity. And this is a problem. Because, so let me take a moment to explain this. So if you have a particle that's like an electron, it has spin. What is spin? It's sort of some intrinsic angular momentum that a particle can carry. And, it's not very easy to visualize, but, I'll draw the ball as a, I'll draw the electron or particle like it as a little ball, it's spinning. In particular, it has a spin axis, and you can quantize the spin axis along the direction of motion and ask, is the spin in the direction of motion or opposite to it? Well, the quantity which tells you whether it's in the same direction or the opposite direction is called helicity, and I'm oversimplifying a little bit, but basically, if you have a massless spin a half particle, helicity is a very interesting thing because it's conserved. Because if a particle is traveling at the speed of light, and it's spinning in one particular direction or the other, it will continue to do so until it hits something. It will continue to do so forever, and all observers will agree that's what it's doing, because for all observers, it's traveling at the speed of light. But if you have a massive spin of half particle, it's not true anymore, because if I have a particle that's traveling this way and its spin axis is in the same direction, I would say it has positive helicity. But another observer who's traveling past me, even faster than this particle, will say the particle's going the other way, but the spin is the same. So for a massive particle, helicity isn't conserved. Different observers disagree about what the helicity is. What this tells you is that mass, if a particle has a mass, it's somehow tying together the particles which, if the particle was massless, would have been independent. You would have independent positive and negative helicity states. These are now tied together by the mass somehow. Well, the problem with this, nothing wrong with that in general, but the problem is once you learn the weak nuclear force violates parity, parity being invariance under a mirror, the world in a mirror is not the same as the world we inhabit. You can tell the difference. There are physical processes that look different. The weak nuclear force can convert neutrinos to electrons and back again. And always the neutrinos that are created in these processes have negative helicity, at least to the extent the neutrino is so light that you don't have to worry about its mass. It's almost exactly true. And what this means is that since you can convert these things back and forth, and angular momentum is conserved, and momentum is conserved, so helicity, at least approximately, is conserved, electrons of negative and positive helicity behave differently in the weak interactions. The mass term that we wrote down in quantum field theory that looked like this treats the negative and positive helicity states exactly the same, symmetrically. So you can't start with this and just combine it with a weak force. It doesn't work. So now you have a problem. You can see in nature the electron is massive. You can see in nature the world is parity asymmetric. And you have no equation which allows you to explain how that can be true all at the same time. Enter the Higgs. Because the Higgs solves this problem. I won't explain how, but it does. What I will explain to you in a little more detail is how the Higgs solves the other problem, which is how do the W and Z particles, the bosons, how do the spin 1 particles, how do they become massive, which is also a serious problem. And the Higgs mechanism is well explained now in detail in the next few slides. Let me just say a few words about it. It was invented in the mid-60s, so again, about 50 years ago. And it was invented actually first in the condensed matter context in a non-relativistic version by Phil Anderson, and hinted at by other people. I mean, it's really a complicated story. And then papers were written by all of these people about a way to do this in a relativistic context, which is relevant for particle physics. And so Higgs got lucky and got his name on it. But there were other people working on this as well. And they all get credit now today. Unfortunately, their names don't form a nice acronym. So no one's thought of a good way to rename the particle. I mean, you know, all these consonants, it's not going to work. OK, the Higgs mechanism. So this is, I'm going to throw some equations at you now. These are all equations which, if you've had, you know, certainly a sophomore, probably junior level physics, you can follow everything I'm going to do. So just bear with me. We're going to start with the equations for a spin zero field, or a scalar field, in other words. What is that? That's just a function of space and time, phi of x, y, z, and t. And you can guess what its equation of motion is. It's going to be the classical wave equation. You've seen that many times. Here it is. And you know the solutions to this equation. They're plane waves. Right? Each plane wave, each wave mode acts as an independent oscillator. And in particular, it has a dispersion relation relating its frequency to its wave number. Okay, now, how does quantum mechanics change this story? Well, quantum mechanics tells you these waves are made from quanta. And those quanta satisfy, according to Einstein and de Broglie, a relation between their energy and their frequency and a relation between their momentum and their wave number. And since you have this dispersion relation, that gives you this relation between energy and momentum, which is Einstein's relation for a massless particle. So the quanta of this field are spin zero particles that are massless. Now, you might like to have spin zero particles that are massive. How would you change things? Well, you can guess. You need to change the Einstein relation, so it's got a mass term here. Now you can just work backwards. That means you need a dispersion relation with something on the right-hand side, which means you need to have started with a wave equation that had something on the right-hand side too. So a constant times phi, where the constant is proportional to the thing that you want to call the mass squared. Okay, simple enough. Just another wave equation you don't work with as often, but it's a perfectly reasonable one. Now, that's fine for spin zero. What about spin one? Well, for spin one massless particles, you know how to do this, because electromagnetism has the same sort of thing. If you choose the appropriate gauge, then the equation for the spin one vector potential is the wave equation again. And for the same reason as before, you get a relation between E and P, which tells you that the quanta of this field are spin one massless photons. But now, supposing we want to have massive spin one W and Z particles. Well, you might guess all you have to do is add a constant times A, and that would be fine, except it violates gauge invariance. In fact, it makes the theory, it means that the quantum mechanics of the theory doesn't make any sense, so you can't do that. Again, you have a problem. You see in nature, there are massive spin one particles. You have equations that don't work. You have to do something. Well, the trick turns out to be to take a spin one particle and a spin zero particle and make them interact with each other in the right way. The details don't matter. It's a little complicated. It's actually simpler than it looks when you understand the structure. But two interesting things to notice. First of all the terms here involve at least A and phi or phi and phi. There's multiple terms. This is going to be the term we're going to watch the most closely. But notice that there's a G in every one of these equations. This G is what we call the coupling strength. This is the strength with which these two fields interact with each other. These are nonlinear coupled wave equations. They're complicated. But they're the kinds of things you find in nature in other contexts. There's nothing wrong with them. We're going to do one more thing. We need to add a potential energy density for the scalar field, which I'll call capital V. It has a shape that looks like this. It has a maximum where the field is zero and a minimum somewhere where the field is not zero. So when you minimize the energy in the universe, the field is going to want to be non-zero. So in other words, this field will have a non-zero expectation value in the vacuum of space. And that expectation value we'll call V, little v. Now, to see what happens now, we're going to shift the field phi by writing it as its expectation value plus small fluctuations around its expectation value. We won't follow all the details, but just watch this term, because what's that term going to do? Well, it's proportional to phi squared, so when we do this, now we get a constant times A, which is what we wanted. And we've done this without violating gauge invariance. So now, in fact, the waves for this field will satisfy the relation for a massive particle. The coupling G appears here. The expectation value of the field phi appears here. So the mass of these particles, these new massive spin one particles, is proportional to G times V. And that's how it works. Well, this appears in nature in superconductors, for example. In a superconductor, the role of phi is played by the density of Cooper pairs. The photon inside of a superconductor is actually massive. It satisfies a dispersion relation for a massive field. And that's what's responsible for screening of the electric field and the Meissner effect. In the context of particle physics, the role of phi is played by a field we call H, the Higgs field. H gets an expectation value. That expectation value has been known for many years to be 246 GeV. As a result of this expectation value, the spin one particles called the Ws and the Z become massive with these masses. The photon remains massless because of the details of how this field is put in. Meanwhile, there are ways that the Higgs field can interact with ordinary fermions, and that is how the electron gets its mass, and the top quark gets its mass, and so forth, as far as we know. And finally, one more thing. This field got an expectation value V, but it can still fluctuate around that expectation value. It can wiggle around this minimum. And those wiggles are a massive scalar field, whose quanta are a massive scalar particle, the Higgs boson. Or at least, that is the prediction of this very simple version of the Higgs mechanism. It can be more complicated. There could be multiple fields. There could be composite things here. It could be really pretty complicated. But in the simplest version, the standard model, there's just one field and one new particle, the Higgs boson. Okay, so here it is. Just a quick summary for you to look at. I've got a spin zero field that gets an expectation value. I've got spin one particles that get a mass. The spin a half fermions get a mass, and the quanta of the waves that oscillate around the expectation value for this field are the Higgs particle in the standard model, the simplest possible version of this. Now, I think it's important to take a step back and look at this in the grand scheme of things. The electron was discovered in 1897. Its mass was measured as part of that discovery. And we have been puzzled, confused, bewildered about why the electron has a mass for all this time. You might have said, well, you know, of course it has a mass. It's matter. It's stuff, right? Well, okay, but the photon doesn't have a mass. So already by 1924, you had this question that, yes, there were multiple types of particles that were known. Some of them have mass. Some of them don't. What's going on? It's not a generic feature of particles to have mass. Some of them do. Some of them don't. And there were simple ways of putting the mass in, and then we ran into the weak nuclear force being parity asymmetric. So it needed something more elaborate than the simple-minded things. And then the Higgs field papers came along in 1964, and Weinberg and also Salam put this all together into a theory of the weak nuclear force based on crucial work by Glashow a few years earlier. That was a theoretical proposal. Now, what about experiment? Well, in the 1970s, people started to think very seriously about how you might make or discover this particle. And in the 80s and 90s, there were proposals for colliders, including the superconducting supercollider in the United States, which was canceled, and the Large Hadron Collider, which was actually built. And searches in other colliders took place in the last couple of decades, and also even before the Large Hadron Collider started looking. And they were able to rule out the possibility of the simplest type of Higgs, the Standard Model Higgs, in a couple of different ranges. But there was still a lot of territory left. And of course, it might not have been the simplest Higgs at all that you were looking for. And then the LHC started running. And in 2012, well, we found there's a particle around 125 GV consistent with being a Higgs particle of some type. So let me say just a few words about the Large Hadron Collider. Again, you'll get a whole colloquium on this in 2 weeks. The Large Hadron Collider is a machine which consists of an underground tunnel with all sorts of fancy equipment in it. And the purpose of that equipment is to store bunches of protons that go round counterclockwise and clockwise and are controlled by big magnets and RF cavities and things like this. All of those things are very, one can manipulate those protons with great precision and arrange that that collisions occur at prescribed places. So in three or four places around the ring, there are collision locations where there are big detectors to detect all the debris from whatever collisions take place. And the goal of these proton-proton collisions is, at a bare minimum, to produce some Higgs particles if they exist. And if there's anything else that might be producible, well, of course, to produce those things too and measure them as best we can. But the real goal of the LHC was to find the Higgs particle so we could start to understand the Higgs field and understand where all this mass comes from. Okay, here's a... Ooh, wait. I think there was a Higgs there. Did somebody... Let's see. Here are two protons. Aren't protons round? And I thought they were made from free quarks. Well, okay. These protons are traveling at nearly the speed of light. So in fact, they're flattened into pancakes by Lorentz contraction, and these are much rounder than they actually should be. Okay, they're little pancakes just because of their high energy. And no, protons are not made from free quarks. They're made from three quarks, a large number of gluons, and a large number of quark-antiquark pairs. And they just don't bother to tell you this most of the time in your beginning particle physics courses. But it's very important at the LHC because the way you produce Higgs particles most of the time is by having a gluon in one of these protons hit a gluon in the other proton. So here we go. Okay. So and we make a Higgs, and then if you had your eyes closed, you missed it. Let's do one more time. Okay. Here we go. So we make a Higgs. The Higgs does not last very long. It falls apart, for example, into two photons. And there's a big, of course, this is all microscopic. There's a huge detector on these scales, a big machine that's basically a camera for detecting particles of various types, including photons. And what you do is you work backwards. You measure those photons, and you work backwards to try to figure out if you made a Higgs particle or not. That's not so easy because there's lots of other ways to make photons in proton-proton collisions. We'll see that in a second. But what people did, and as was presented on July 4th, was... they looked at all their proton-proton collisions over a period of a year and a half or so, some ridiculously large number of them, which unfortunately I forgot to double-check before I came in here. So I won't try to remember it right now, but it's something like 10 to the 15 collisions. And you hope that in there maybe you're making a Higgs, and the Higgs is decaying to two photons some of the time. So you take all the collisions that have two photons, you count how many you have, as a function of the invariant mass of those two photons. Because if you have a particle that's decaying to two photons, the invariant mass of the two photons will be the mass of the particle that you started with. So if you look at the data, and here is the data as it was presented, all of this stuff back here, again, this is a function of the mass of the invariant mass of the two photons and the number of events. You see there's lots and lots of data, and all this smooth stuff out here is just random ways of making two photons. But there's this bump, which is what you would expect if you have a particle of a definite mass that's decaying to two photons some of the time. And this is the data from CMS. This is the data from ATLAS. They also see a bump. These bumps are not hugely convincing by themselves, but they're pretty good. And then you can do the same thing using the fact that sometimes the Higgs decays to four leptons is the way people usually say it. Two lepton pairs, another way to say it. All this really means is either an electron and positron or muon and antimuon and two of those. Okay, four leptons or whatever you want to call it. You look at all the collisions that have four leptons, you plot the invariant mass of those four leptons, and here's the data. And again, try to ignore all those curves. The curves are there just trying to guide your eye, which is actually not such a good thing here. Just look at the dots. The dots are the data. Okay? There's extra dots here. I mean, there's extra events here. This is one event. This is two events. There are three. There are about four or five extra events right in this location. Also, there are extra ones down here. And both of these locations are at 125 to 126 GeV, which is the same place that we saw the photons. Okay. So it's four separate measurements from two measurements from two experiments that are all pointing to the presence of a particle of the same mass. And altogether, it looks pretty convincing. There's something there. And the rates for these processes are consistent with a Higgs particle. Now, is this a Higgs particle? We don't know yet. There's a lot of other questions you should ask. In my view, we know enough already to be pretty confident. I can explain that later if anyone's interested. Could it be something else? Well, this is a way of answering that question. The answer is yes, it could be, but this thing looks like a Higgs within a factor of two or better in terms of how it behaves. And so anything else, kind of accidental that it looks so much like a Higgs. We'll know a lot more even by November and certainly by March, because there's a lot more data being collected this year, and we'll have results at that time. And then we're not going to know very much for a while after that, because the machine will be shut down from 2013 and 2014 for upgrades and repairs. Some data analysis will continue. We may learn new things about other searches for other types of new particles, but probably most of what we'll know about the Higgs from the current run will be known by March. Maybe a bit more will be found. And surprises could happen afterwards. Now, the big question, and this is going to be the theme for the rest of the talk, is, are we dealing with the standard model, or are we not dealing with the standard model? Is this a theory? Are we living in a world with one Higgs field, or, let's say, several of them, each with its own type of Higgs particle? Have we found the Higgs particle, or just the first of many? Is this an elementary particle from an elementary field, like an electron? Or is it a composite object, like a proton, made from other things? We don't know. If I had given this colloquium last year, or even the beginning of this year, I would have had to say, is it possible that you can have a Higgs field with no Higgs particle at all? And the answer is yes. And you can ask Bob Holdham about that. You could certainly have a field that does all the things a Higgs field is supposed to do and not have a particle that you can observe. But data seems to say there is a particle there, so I probably don't have to explain this one now anymore. So ask Bob. Okay, so it would appear that we have a candidate Higgs particle, and that particle is consistent so far with the Higgs of the standard model, the simplest type of Higgs. We don't know that it's of the simplest type yet, but there's nothing in the data which says it isn't. So that raises the question. Maybe this part of our understanding of the world, the standard model with this Higgs added in now, forms a consistent set of equations. There's nothing that has to be added. Maybe that's it for the Large Hadron Collider. Maybe that's all we're going to find there. Well, it's possible. It's worth thinking about. If it's true, it comes at a very high price. And that price is called the hierarchy problem, or puzzle. And I want to explain that now in some detail. So what makes a quantum harmonic oscillator special compared to a classical harmonic oscillator? Well, of course, there are several things, but one of the most surprising things about the quantum harmonic oscillator is zero-point energy, that even in the ground state, there's energy 1/2 h bar omega in the system. Well, as we already discussed, a quantum field, well, a classical field already is really a set of oscillators, a set of wave modes. And a quantum field is a set of, essentially, it's an infinite set of coupled oscillators per unit volume. And the zero-point energy density, therefore, is infinite, at least formally, the energy per unit volume. Well, it's huge. Well, infinite, I don't know. Maybe it's infinite, maybe it's not. But is it a problem that there's this infinite zero-point energy? Well, at one level, no. And first of all, one level is probably not infinite. And that's because, look, space-time is probably quantum mechanical. There's probably some scale, the gravitational scale, at 10 to the minus 33 meters that I think I put on one slide way in the back, this incredibly tiny distance scale, 10 to the minus 34 meters, I guess I have it written here. And probably you can't really think about the coupled oscillators going down all the way. There's probably some sense in which the energy is cut off of the gravitational scale and the volume is cut off of the gravitational scale. So the probably this constant isn't infinite, but it's just still really big. Should we worry about this? Well, it's a constant. And we all know that if you have a constant of if you have a constant amount of energy and you add it to the Hamiltonian of your system, it doesn't change the equation of motion. There's no dynamics associated with adding a constant amount of energy. So in that sense, no, you don't have to worry about it. It doesn't affect anything, at least as long as you ignore gravity. Well, last time I checked, gravity seems to work pretty well. We probably shouldn't ignore it. And this constant is what we call the cosmological constant. It is a source of energy density. And by all rights, it should be blowing the universe apart long ago. And we have no idea why it's not there. There seems to be a cosmological constant in nature, but it's much, 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 much smaller than this by 120 orders of magnitude. So that's a little disturbing. But we have worse problems. Because it's not even constant. You can't argue that you can't ignore it, that you can just ignore it. Because even without gravity, you have to pay attention, because this is a zero-point energy from all these harmonic oscillators. The harmonic oscillators are from these fields. The fields have frequencies, the dispersion relations, that depend on the mass of the field. The mass of the field depends on the Higgs field. And therefore, the energy density is a function of the Higgs field. So when I stick my constant, quote, into the Hamiltonian, it's actually got Higgs field dependence. It does change the equations of motion. You can't ignore it. And in fact, what you're doing here is you're changing the potential energy for the Higgs. Remember, in order to get the Higgs to have an expectation value, I added some potential energy for it. But it's just been changed by this quantum effect. So I have to go back now and check, what does the Higgs field actually do as a result of all these quantum fluctuations, these zero-point energy effects? So the problem is that I said, well, maybe I'm going to take a potential energy which has this nice little shape with a zero here and a minimum over here, and that minimum will be at 246 GeV. That's 10 to the minus 15 of the Planck mass, the gravitational scale, C squared. And really, the potential might look like this as a result of all these quantum corrections. They're huge. They completely change the answer. This is not to scale. The actual expectation value of the Higgs would more naturally be at 10 to the 15 times larger than we actually observe because of the zero-point energy that depends on the Higgs field. So you would expect V to be at the Planck scale and not at 10 to the minus 15 the Planck scale. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that instead of looking like this, the Higgs potential looks like that. It folds up. In that case, you'd expect the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs to be zero. Well, one or the other, but not this 10 to the minus 15 thing. The natural place for the Higgs expectation value to be should be 0 or of order 1 in Planck units and not 10 to the minus 15. That's the hierarchy problem. Why is the Higgs expectation value not 0 but also really tiny? Well, in either one of these cases, the Higgs boson would have an enormous mass. You could see that in the previous case. If the potential is bound up and folded up like this, the energy required to get anything oscillating in there is going to be huge. And you can also check that for the other case. The Higgs boson should have an enormous mass. There shouldn't be some particle that we can discover at the LHC. And worse than that, the energy scale of the weak nuclear force should either be the Planck scale, which would be huge, or it should be zero. And not, you know, we shouldn't have W and Z bosons with masses of 80 and 90 GeV. It doesn't make any sense. It's completely unnatural in this by this argument for there to be any observable Higgs boson. But on the other hand, you look at data, you look at experiment, there are particles in the standard model, we can observe them, we can observe how they behave. We need a Higgs boson there for the standard model to make sense. It has to be lighter than 1 TeV. So there's this conflict. We even see this one in the data now, it would appear. So we can't get away from this conflict. So either the standard model is incomplete, there's something missing, you have to add something to it to fix this problem, or the hierarchy argument I gave you, which just depended on zero-point energy, is so fundamental, is wrong somehow, or misleading, or confused. It's a very deep problem. Another way to say this is if there is really in nature a light spin zero particle with no other structure, no additional particles, forces, and so forth, to somehow solve this hierarchy problem by complicating the story in some way, this is flying in the face of our understanding of quantum field theory in a very profound sense. The naturalness arguments of this type, that you shouldn't see particles that do this, have worked in particle physics in the past. And they've worked throughout condensed matter physics in the past, where we've used quantum field theory many times. So we don't have examples previous to this where these types of arguments have failed. So if it really does fail here, if the hierarchy argument is wrong, this is mysterious indeed. And even though the standard model, as I told you, is the simplest repair, it's the simplest thing you can do to solve the problem of the fact that without a Higgs, the standard model isn't a consistent theory. It may be the simplest repair, but in many ways, it's the most radical. Because you're putting something in that, by all these arguments, shouldn't be possible. So if what comes out of the Large Hadron Collider after many years of study is just the standard model, that is not a minor discovery. It will leave many unsolved problems. Of course, the hierarchy problem I just mentioned, that's the $10 to the $15 question. But not being able to solve that problem will also, at least we'll have solved one problem, okay? The mass problem. We have a Higgs particle, apparently we have a Higgs field, we have a solution to why is there mass at all, but we still have the problem of why the specific masses, why that weird pattern of masses. There are also issues with some of the decays of the particles. For example, why is the top quark so heavy? We have no understanding of that just because we have a Higgs field. And there are other problems, like the CP problem. There's a symmetry that's violating the weak nuclear force, but it's not violated by the strong nuclear force. It should be. Nobody understands it. And there's more of them. You know, why does the electron have two heavy cousins and not six of them? Why are there three non-gravitational forces, or four, depending on how you count, in the standard model? What's dark matter? Why is there dark matter? I mean, we have a lot of problems here. They're very deep. And if the LHC just gives us the standard model and nothing else, they're going to get deeper. So for this reason, most particle physicists, most theorists, have spent a lot of time thinking about alternatives to the standard model, because the standard model would be so shocking. And all of those alternatives involve additional heavy particles, or additional Higgs fields, or new forces, or all of the above. And the expectation, if you ask most theorists, was not necessarily that they would have any expectation about which one of the possibilities would be right. But most people in the theory community, for the reasons I've explained, would have expected something here in addition to the Higgs particle itself, if at all. Well, let me just mention a few solutions you may have heard about. One of them is the possibility the Higgs field is a composite field, the Higgs particle is a composite particle, because there are new forces up at the TeV scale. That there's some new particles up there, and they're bound together to make this Higgs thingy. And as a result of that, the calculation of the zero-point energy that I did is wrong, because I assumed that I could treat the Higgs field as an ordinary field all the way up to the Planck scale in energy. And that's just not true. So that would solve the problem. There are different variants of this idea. Another possibility is something called supersymmetry. That's a particularly beautiful, mathematically beautiful and striking idea. Quite surprising, where you use the fact that fermionic fields have a negative zero-point energy, while bosonic fields have a positive zero-point energy. And if you arrange that for every field in nature that's a boson, there's a corresponding fermion field that is not too far away in energy scale, not too far away in mass. So let's say the electron would have a partner, which is a spin-zero particle that can't be too heavy, may not heavier than a TeV, for example. Then the zero-point energy associated with their respective fields would mostly cancel. And again, rather than having a huge correction to the Higgs potential energy, you'd get a more manageable one. But for that to work, there has to be, for every particle in nature, has to have a partner. That if the particle is a boson, there's a fermion partner. If there's a fermion, then it has a boson partner. It has to be true for every particle in nature. Third possibility is that, you know, I was saying the Planck scale is 10 to the 15 times larger than the TeV scale. Maybe that's wrong. Maybe, in fact, space-time is more complicated than you think. There are actually extra dimensions at the TeV scale, dimensions we are not able to see in ordinary experiments, but which are actually present, and we'll start discovering at the LHC. And that brings the gravitational scale and space-time down to, brings the Planck scale down to 1 TeV. So then my argument was correct, except that when I said things get moved to the Planck scale, I put the wrong number in. So those are three classes of possibilities. All of these, and any others that have been written down, all predict new particles or forces or other types of phenomena that the Large Hadron Collider should be able to find eventually. So, of course, people are looking for them. And up to now, well, lots of different approaches, lots of different search strategies you can use. We're talking absolutely enormous data sets, and there are lots of different things you can try to do, and it's going to take a long time to be really exhaustive. So right now, people are looking for things that are relatively easy to find, as well as, now that we have this Higgs particle, testing the standard model predictions for it, looking at, you know, poking it and prodding it, looking at how often, you know, well, trying to understand as best we can. I'll say maybe a little bit more about that in a minute. So far, nothing. The standard model is looking very in very good shape. There's no sign of any breakdown in quantum field theory as a whole, for sure. Many, although not all, scenarios where you have a composite Higgs are on the verge of being excluded or excluded. For other things, it's still pretty ambiguous. For example, for supersymmetry, some versions are now disfavored by the data. There are still others. We're not done yet. Same for extra dimensions, same for certain types of hidden sectors with dark matter and stuff like that in them. There's a long way to go before we'll know for sure. And that's what I have to emphasize. We are still in the early stages of the Large Hadron Collider. We have a lot of data now, but it's still only a few percent of the total data we're going to see collected in the next few years. And many types of data analysis strategies which could find something have not been tried yet, the harder ones, the trickier ones. So some of those will still be being tried in 2013 and 2014 while the machine is shut down. So there's still a lot of information that needs to come out before we can draw any conclusions. All right, so let me just say that again, we're looking for stuff that might be here, maybe we won't find any. And if that's the case, if all we find at the Large Hadron Collider is that this story right here appears to be consistent with all with the data as far as we can see, it's really an extraordinary situation. So our focus is now, as we've found a particle consistent with the Higgs, the focus now shifts from looking for such a particle to testing whether the standard model, at least within the context of the LHC, is the right theory for describing all the phenomena there or not. Now, theoretically, as I've emphasized, this is night versus day. Okay, if we indeed find the LHC at the LHC that the standard model is not correct, then that means that's incredibly exciting. It means there's some new phenomenon we have to add into this story that could potentially shed light on many of these puzzles that I mentioned. Certainly on the hierarchy problem, maybe on the flavor problem, maybe on some of the other things. It will be an enormously exciting time if these particles are discovered. On the other hand, if we only find the standard model of the Large Hadron Collider, that's exciting in a very different way because we don't get to solve the puzzles now. The puzzles just get deeper. But they certainly remain very important because we have, for the first time, a lightweight, lonesome elementary scalar, something that looks just like it. So in our heads, as we face this, particle physicists have a problem. We don't know which direction we're going to go. We have to kind of live with our brains potentially going in two very different directions. And we have another problem, which is that experimentally, the difference between these two situations may very well be night versus twilight. It is the case that in many theories that are not the standard model, that have extra things added in, that the difference between the standard model and these things is experimentally very challenging to observe. For example, the effects on the Higgs particle, which we'll study in great detail in the next few years, may be only at the 10% level, 10, 20% level. These are hard to measure. Even with the huge rates at the LHC, these could be very difficult to detect. And yes, there may be new particles out there, but they may be ones that are hard to discover, not so easy to find using the methods we've used so far. So experimentally, we have a real challenge here to know which path we're really on. And because of this, one of the things that really has to happen in the field is extreme attention to getting every ounce of information out of the data from the LHC. We have to learn everything we can, and we still face the problem, even when we do that, that you can prove a theory is false, but you can't prove it's true. All you have to do to prove it's false is find something that disagrees with it. To prove it's true, you have to prove everything agrees with it. Well, you can never really do that. Maybe if you just measure something with a little bit more precision, you'd find it doesn't work. So obviously, if we're on this path, we'll be a lot happier because we'll learn it and we'll know for sure that it's the case. If, in fact, the standard model at the LHC is correct, we're never going to be entirely sure. So the goals of the LHC for the next few years are therefore running at 8 TeV per collision right now in 2012, and then shut down for a couple of years and running from 2015 to at least 2018, probably longer, at 13 to 14 TeV per collision, and quite possibly upgraded maybe in energy or maybe in collision rate down the line, depending on what's discovered and what the plans are as a result of that, are, first of all, to make precision measurements of this new particle. You know, is it really Higgs? Does it behave exactly the way it's supposed to in the standard model, or does it have other properties? For example, first of all, we've got to check and make sure it really is spin zero and it really has other properties it's supposed to have. That's probably true. But then we have to measure all of the ways in which it's produced. There are five of them. And we have to measure all the ways in which it decays. There are six or seven that are measurable. And check, does it decay in any way we don't expect? Is it produced in any way we don't expect? Are there any other Higgs particles or Higgs-like particles out there? And we'll keep looking, meanwhile, for other particles or forces that aren't predicted by the standard model using other techniques. And we'll be testing the standard model in many contexts with as high precision as we can in many other measurements. For example, we'll be checking, is the top quark really as predicted in the standard model at the 1% level, at the half a percent level, the 10th percent level, as far as we can go? All the goal being to figure this out. Are we in the standard model or are we not? Standard model is the best game in town. It's the simplest game in town. Everything is working as far as it's concerned. So it's the thing to beat, and there are many possibilities for what the not standard model might be. And one of the things that happens when you give a talk for the first time is sometimes you're done before you expect. So I'm at my conclusions. So to sum up, a new particle's been found. This hasn't happened for a while. It's very exciting. It's consistent with some type of Higgs particle, and it's also consistent so far with that of the standard model, the simplest type. The standard model, however, has many profound puzzles. And it's hard to believe that that's really right. It might be. I mean, nature is nature. We're going to find out. But it is hard to get one's head around it. The Higgs field has a role to play in the standard model. It gives mass to most of the standard model particles. And it explains how particles can have mass at all. That's good. But it doesn't tell us why the electron has the mass it does, why the top quark has the mass it does. It doesn't answer those questions. So that's a huge puzzle. And then, of course, there's the hierarchy problem, which is the big elephant in the room. Why is the weak nuclear force have a scale that is neither zero nor up at the gravitational scale, the Planck scale? And why? How is it possible there can be a lightweight spin zero particle like the Higgs just sitting there with nothing else? All the solutions to that hierarchy problem that we know about will, by necessity, have to add particles in that are at low energy scales, low enough that the Large Hadron Collider can find them. So far, there's no sign of them. But it's still early days. So my message to you, then, is to stay tuned as we test the heck out of the standard model. Thank you. I guess I left extra time for questions.